Hello, I'm Thomas Lewis, and welcome to The Big Interview. My guest today is the editor-in-chief of one of the world's most storied magazine titles, National Geographic. Susan Goldberg became the magazine's 10th editor and the first woman to lead the 129-year-old publication when she was appointed in 2014. A year later, she also became the editorial director of National Geographic Partners, the expanded joint venture owned by the National Geographic Society and 21st Century Fox, combining the magazine's digital content with National Geographic's television channel, making her, in effect, one of the most influential figures in US publishing. Born in Michigan, Susan Goldberg has had a long and accomplished career in journalism in the United States. She was an executive editor at Bloomberg News in Washington, D.C., following several senior positions at major newspapers across the U.S. She served as editor at the Plain Dealer in Cleveland, the largest newspaper in Ohio, and led the San Jose Mercury News. Her impressive resume in U.S. journalism also includes senior positions at USA Today and the Detroit Free Press. She is still a member of the board of the American Society of Newspaper Editors. Under her leadership, National Geographic has won two National Magazine Awards and the George Polk Award for Magazine Reporting. In 2015, Goldberg herself was honoured by the Exceptional Women in Publishing organisation. She remains, she says, a passionate journalist and a firm believer in National Geographic's mission in funding groundbreaking scientists and explorers and sharing their findings with the world. I'm delighted to say that Susan Goldberg joins me today in Washington, D.C. Susan Goldberg, thank you ever so much for joining us on The Big Interview today.
Thank you for asking me.
I wanted to begin by talking about the magazine that you run. One thing that's cut through, arguably, since National Geographic's inception are the covers, I think it's fair to say. Walk us through the process of how the covers come to be, and maybe some of your favourites or some of the proudest you've been of in your time as editor-in-chief.
Well, I'm really proud of the current cover on gender with Avery Jackson, who is a 9-year-old transgender girl. And it is a portrait of her, and it's a very simple cover. It just says Gender Revolution, and there's a picture of this girl with pink hair and a pink top and pink pants. She's wearing all pink because that's what she was wearing when she answered the door when the photographer came. And the only other thing on the cover is a quote from Avery, and she says, "The best thing about being a girl is now I don't have to pretend to be a boy." And wow, what an incredibly profound sentence. And so we put her picture where she looks so proud and so strong and her amazing words on that cover because we thought it just absolutely summed up so much of the conversation going on about gender right now. I just loved that cover. Another cover that I am really crazy about is the one that we did in May for our Yellowstone special issue. So it was an entire issue devoted to Yellowstone. We had a year's worth of stories on national parks timed to the 100th anniversary of the National Park Service here in the United States. Our Yellowstone cover, you know, it's kind of got this old-timey picture of Yellowstone and it's got kind of old-timey print on it. It's fantastic. It speaks of this special place at the time when it really began, which I think was in 1872. And so it sort of looks like that, but better than they would have done it in 1872. So I love that cover too. Sometimes you'll have something and you'll think, oh, this is great. And then you'll put it out and the stories may be great. And that's not really the issue. So you get it into the homes of your subscribers and people are happy. But then you put it on the newsstand, which is a different measure of how you're connecting, and it doesn't go anywhere. And you just go, oh, that just killing me. So the process is hard. I mean, we try a variety of images and also a lot of different words. Getting that headline right is so important. So sometimes the best headlines we find, particularly on the newsstand, are the simplest. So, Gender Revolution, Yellowstone, And then the subtitle on that was The Battle for the American West. So it said Yellowstone, The Battle for the American West. Our best-selling issue in 4 years was Weed, The Science of Marijuana. And that has been our best-selling issue in 4 years. So we have learned, really, that the simple titles are the best. So those are the kinds of headlines that work for us. But it's a long process, and we debate and among ourselves, and I put them up on a wall, and I stare at them, and other people stare at them, and we talk to our circulation people, and then we argue, and it's really hard.
National Geographic is one of the most storied sort of publications in US kind of world publishing. What kind of role does it play today, and has it played in your view?
It's such a good question. I mean, National Geographic is one of the biggest brands in the world, really. And it's a brand that people trust and they think is authentic and they have very, very, very fond memories of. And every time you meet somebody and you say you're from National Geographic, they are sure to tell you, oh, I grew up reading National Geographic, or my grandfather subscribed and there's still 500 pounds of National Geographics in the attic or in the basement or wherever they are. And you always hear this story. Well, and the other story you hear, frankly, is from a man of a certain age. He will tell you, or he always tells me in great detail, that National Geographic is where he saw his first female breasts. And I have heard so many stories. But, you know, I think the challenge today with National Geographic is making sure that people understand that National Geographic is remade for the modern age. So, yes, we might be in your grandfather's attic, but we are telling stories about climate change and the environment and about gender and about scientific breakthroughs. We're telling stories that millennials really care about and that this next generation of readers and users need to know about. And that's really both the challenge and the blessing of having this legacy brand.
Legacy brands, I suppose that the challenge quite often is how that process of adapting works without chipping away, by staying true to the brand and its history and its legacy all bound up together. Has that been a sort of natural process, would you say, from inside National Geographic, as I suppose readers' appetites and interests have shifted too, as our understanding of various things have changed?
Sure. Our values are the same, and our idea of stories, good storytelling, you know, it should be visual, it should be global, it needs to be deeply reported, it should have maps and graphics and illustrations, it should be unique. You really shouldn't be able to get this content everywhere else. So we stay true to that. What I think is changing are two things. One is the subjects that we're tackling, the kinds of subjects that we're tackling. I think that our content needs to be part of the national conversation, or maybe we can even create a national conversation. I want it to be really relevant. And then, of course, the other way our content is changing is the platforms that we're putting it out on. Before, of course, you know, we were a monthly magazine. Well, now we're a monthly magazine, but we're also a website that publishes stories every single day. We are the largest social media presence in the United States. You can get our stories on Snapchat. You can see them on Twitter, on Facebook. We have amazing videos. And increasingly, we're working in coordination with National Geographic Channel, the most widely distributed cable channel in the world. So, you know, our values are the same, but our story choices are different. And of course, our means of communicating with readers is different.
I'd love to discuss the sort of business of kind of diversifying how you publish your stories, be it sort of via cable or social media. But you used the phrase a national conversation and National Geographic's role within that. We are sitting in the United States at a time where the national conversation has taken a form, I suppose, that many people are surprised by, are delighted by, I suppose, in some ways. From the content that National Geographic produces, the science, the storytelling, does this atmosphere that we're in at the moment worry you, or does it give a sort of extra importance to the kind of stories that the National Geographic publishes, do you think?
I mean, I think both things are true. I would say that I do worry about what is going to happen with the environment I worry a little bit about policies that could result in funds being shifted away from supporting the environment, helping the environment, cleaning up the environment. I worry about funds perhaps being shifted away from studying climate change. I think those things are very important. But it is an opportunity for a place like National Geographic, given this climate, to do fact-based, authoritative, non-politically driven reporting about subjects like the environment and climate change. And I would also include in there our publication just last month of the gender issue, looking at traditional gender roles and how they play out around the world and in the United States, and also looking at the issue of transgender. We just had 1 million women marching in the United States. That was a gender-based march. So I think that that is an opportunity and an example of how we can, you know, help drive conversation and be part of the conversation.
But we are becoming increasingly used to the phrase alternative facts or post-truth. How does it concern you that by being objective, by trying to follow a theme or story straight down the line, that actually the environment we're in at the moment, there are maybe people that don't want to listen or don't really care if it doesn't quite fit into kind of the preconceptions they are fostering or have garnered over many years or more recently? Does that worry you?
There have always been a group of people who didn't want to listen. I mean, it's an old expression to say you can have your own opinions, but you can't have your own facts. So I think this is actually not a new problem. It does seem that the notion, though, of alternate facts has taken on a life of its own. Be that as it may, I do think that given we are, you know, all about the facts, and we will follow where the science takes us and where the reporting takes us. And that's what makes us strong. That's what makes us distinctive. And that's got to be our position in the market.
Why is there so much doubt about, you know, listening to experts seemingly or listening to people who are so well versed in their field? Why are we seemingly in a time where actually someone who knows nothing about, and I'm not referring to anyone in particular, but someone who knows anything at all about a subject suddenly has way more traction than someone who spent their entire lives exploring, be it an element of the environment or gender studies, as you said it. Why do you think that is?
Well, we are so interested in that we did a cover story on that exact topic, and it was called The War on Science. We did it in 2014. It was one of our best-selling issues of the year, and it explored exactly why is it that some people completely reject scientific information. And one of the major conclusions of it was that it's because of the politicization of information and how some people just don't want to accept information if it's coming from a Twitter feed or a Facebook feed that is different from the one that they see. And I do think this is, you know, there's so many great things about the digital age and the internet, but one of the not good things about it has been the abilities for all of us to create our own echo chambers surrounded by people who share our views, and we create our own set of facts. And I think I'm probably as guilty of it as anybody, but I really try hard to fight against it. It used to be when you were reading a newspaper, you're turning the pages and you're seeing all kinds of stuff that you agree with or don't agree with, that you're interested in, that you're not interested in. Now it's so easy just to go down those rabbit holes of subject area and fact, and that is a bad thing.
How can you crack that bubble, therefore, do you think? Is it an uncrackable thing?
I don't know if you can crack it, but you sure can chip away at it. And I believe the way to do it is to create content that is so compelling and that will create so much interest and that everybody wants to talk about. They want to see the pictures. They want to see what we've got digitally. They want to look at our super cool infographics, that they are actually drawn to it in spite of themselves. And then maybe once people get there, they go, oh, I didn't know that.
How sort of traditional sort of print media sort of responded to the changing times and
the media having so much focus cast upon it, both in a very negative way, but also in quite a real way in terms of, well, newsroom budgets are falling. You know, sending reporters out into the field is expensive and is more difficult to do when, you know, readerships are falling and finding advertising in new ways is difficult. Do you, in your mind, from all your experience, have any sort of solutions to that?
As it is, you know, most legacy media, and I would include newspapers and magazines, most of our money still comes out of our print products. So you've got a situation where the declining product is still making more money, and the growing product, the digital product, is not making enough money to support the journalism that you're doing. And so those lines are not going in the right direction. So clearly, we've got to figure out a model, and some folks have been, I would say the New York Times is starting to be really successful, by way of example, of figuring out a subscription model to get digital content paid for. I don't think, though, anybody has completely figured it out. Newsroom budgets have been slashed brutally because of what's happened with print advertising, and the print advertising model is one that is, it's on the ropes. Let's just say the print advertising model is on the ropes. So yeah, there have been enormous cutbacks, and that was true at the newspapers that I ran. Fewer reporters, fewer people on the streets. It used to be that regional newspapers, the big ones, had people in overseas bureaus. I don't really know any regional newspapers that have people overseas anymore. So yeah, we have seen this change, and it definitely has hurt the news coverage. But what I think newspapers, the best ones anyway, continue to do is they continue to focus on the communities that they serve and to do the kind of news that those communities can't get anywhere else. And the best local newspapers are doing investigative journalism on their local communities because people can't go to AP or anywhere else to get that kind of information.
I suppose one of the, you know, responses to the election result in November was that, you know, journalism had maybe failed because in the national forum, those stories in local communities, those things that ultimately made the political process kind of upend itself, I suppose, kind of weren't being shown. And the refrain was that, you know, had missed all of this stuff in plain sight, really. In terms of, you know, pretty pure reporting on local stories, on communities, on people, has there been a sort of forgetting of that? Should there be a sort of return to it? Or are those sort of days gone by?
I think the problem in the last election was that the people at the biggest, most important news organizations really didn't hear what was going on in the heartland of the country. I mean, I'm from Michigan. Okay, that was one of the key states in this last election. And I ran the biggest paper in Ohio, another important Midwestern state. And I know that people from the Times and the Post and, you know, the major networks would come into those places and do stories and then leave. But I don't think that people on the coasts really understand fully the sense of grievance and hardship that has gripped so much of the middle of the country.
Why the grievance and hardship now, in your view, as having been from?
Well,
and
I mean, have you ever been to Youngstown, Ohio?
I have not, no.
Or, you know, parts of Cleveland or parts of Detroit? It's hard to see what's happened to those cities. Some of those places have really been hollowed out. And, you know, I accept that we live in a global society and globalization is the wave of the future. But there have been people really hurt by those global economic trends, and I don't think we were paying enough attention. Except there was one candidate who heard that and saw it and did pay attention and spoke to, you know, a group of people.
You refer to the women's marches that happened here in Washington, D.C., happened in cities around the world. You're the first woman to lead National Geographic, and you've been quoted in the past as saying that it would be nice to live in a day where, you know, a first woman, sort of anything, really isn't part of the description of you or whoever of your counterparts or colleagues. When will that day be, do you think? Why is it still a label that, you know,
seems to be important? I don't know. It's so frustrating to me that in 2017, when a woman gets a big job, you know, everybody's sort of so shocked, and it becomes a national news story because it's still so unusual that there are not enough female leaders or people in that leadership pipeline, that it's just that here's a terrific person for that role, or even here's a bad person for that role. But it's always here's a woman doing that job, and she's the first this or the first that. And gosh, once we aren't saying, you know, somebody's the first this or the first that, we will be in a far more equitable place. When that day is coming, I'm not sure. And this is something that I think a lot about and talk about, because we really haven't made much progress. For a while there, you know, in the 80s and the 90s, there was significant progress being made in terms of female leadership of all kinds of organizations and businesses. And then really in the last 10 or 15 years, it has stalled, and in some places has even gone backwards. In the news business, we definitely have plateaued. And I think part of the reason is because of the financial upheaval that hit the industry in general. And so we went from being organizations that really cared a lot about diversity, that put a lot of focus on making sure we had diverse pools, that news organizations and their companies were very proud to have female leaders and people of color leading those organizations. We went from a lot of conversation about that to a conversation really only about economics and surviving this sea change that has occurred in our business model. So once we took our eye off that ball, I think we lost some ground. Now I believe that people are focusing again on having female and diverse leadership, because if you're a news organization, it's so important that you have diversity within your own organization. It's pretty hard to report on a diverse society if your organization is not diverse.
As National Geographic, you know, itself was adapting to how to get its material out there, and you've outlined the sort of various kind of social, sort of online places that National Geographic material now exists. Was there ever a concern that that would take away from the core product? So the printed magazine that people still treasure, still hold, will keep for the rest of their lives. How did you, from a business point of view, answer that question? So balancing out kind of how to get your stuff out there, get more people in, but also to make sure people are still coming back and buying the magazine.
Oh, I absolutely. That was a huge concern. And when I first got to National Geographic, we had our text editors, our print editors, and they were, you know, editing for the print magazine. And then there was a separate group that was just a digital group, and they were producing stories and editing only for digital. And I was there for a while, and, you know, about 2 weeks, and I'm watching this operation, and the text editors were these very veteran, experienced editors, and the digital editors were, by and large, a whole lot younger and really not very experienced. And I watched this, and I finally called everybody into my office, and I said, we are not two separate groups. We are one group of people who produce stories, and we are going to produce them for all of our platforms. And guess what, text editors? Now you're going to edit digital stories too. And guess what, digital people? I'd like to sometimes have you write for the magazine or get involved in text. And it's taken a while. I've been there 3 years now. But I feel like we've got a really cohesive group of folks now who are editing across platforms. I can't tell you everybody liked it. A couple people left. They didn't want to do that. And that's okay, because it allowed me to then hire some people who can edit across platforms, who can edit short and long and fast and slow, and who understand that the cadence sometimes has to be immediate. And for some of our other work, it can be, let's plan for next year.
And looking at the cable channel, as you say, it's the widest, most distributed cable channel anywhere in the world.
Well, our channel, and I want to be clear, I don't run our channel. I do all of the other editorial, but I don't do the channel. That's run by my colleague, Courtney Monroe, who's the CEO. You know, they have really invested enormously in the last year in creating even better quality content that is even more aligned with really the National Geographic brand. So they are investing in wonderfully high-end stories. We just had recently a series on Mars, on people landing on Mars in 2030. And what I loved about that is, okay, you could watch that story in Washington and you could watch that story on the National Geographic overseas, but it was also the cover of National Geographic magazine. It was the cover of National Geographic Kids magazine, Mars was, told in a kid-like way. We had a book out on Mars and how, you know, all about the red planet and colonizing the red planet. We produced a beautiful big map of Mars and what it would be like and what we'd have to go through to actually, you know, live on Mars. And we created an enormous amount of digital and social content around Mars. So what we're really trying to do when we find the right subjects is to lean in on them across all of our platforms and make a lot of noise in the market, because there's a blizzard of information. It's so hard to cut through and get noticed. And so I think that when we work with the channel, we have an opportunity to really cut through and people can see that great content and can hear about it.
Is that still a thrilling part of the job to you, the creative sort of part of distilling the stories that are the heart of what National Geographic does? You yourself have said on several occasions about how storytelling effectively comes first.
The only thrill is the story. For me, I mean, I don't really love figuring out newsroom budgets, and I don't, you know, love a lot of those other parts that come with being a manager or administrator. But there is nothing more thrilling than leading journalists and creating an atmosphere where people can tell the very, very best stories that make a difference in communities, whether that community is the San Jose Mercury News or the Cleveland Plain Dealer or now National Geographic, where I feel like we've got an opportunity now through our storytelling to make a difference all over the world.
And you've been in the position for 3 years. Mm-hmm. What have you got your sights on? What are you hoping for in the years to come in terms of the kind of magazine you think National Geographic might evolve into in the sort of near future, even the longer term?
Well, I think we're establishing ourselves across our platforms, and we are really building our expertise at creating content for all of those platforms. And we're continuing to reinvent as new platforms come along and new means of distribution come along. So, you know, 2 years ago, we weren't telling stories on Snapchat. Today, we've got, you know, millions and millions of young people every month coming to us through Snapchat. You know, Instagram is another example. So this is a relatively new thing for us. Now we've got 80 million followers. So I think, you know, we continue to push forward on how we're putting stories out there. But, you know, the heart and the soul of a National Geographic story should always be in compelling narratives, factual journalism, and stunning visuals. That shouldn't change. But what I do hope is that we continue to lean into topics that are part of the conversation. So gender was a great example. We're talking about doing some other special issues coming up that I think will be similarly conversation drivers. But on the journalism end of it, you know, we have an opportunity to still, unlike so many other organizations, go all over the world and spend the time it takes to really dig into these incredibly important stories that are unfolding and present them in ways that are so compelling that people will feel like, gosh, I've got to find out more about that.
Susan Goldberg, thank you very much for joining us on this edition of The Big Interview.
The Big Interview is produced by Gaia Lutz and edited by Dia Cesar. Until next time here on The Big Interview, and from me, Tomos Lewis, all that's left to say is goodbye and thank you very much for listening.